Today's May 14th, 2018. This is episode 446.
It's the Kyle Hyman Show on Redeemer Radio.
On today's show, Father Dave Vores joined me at Banditos for Flavor of the Week Part 1 as we discuss his family life, vocational call, and try some Mexican pizza called Crispies. Catholic Answers apologist and author Carlo Broussard chats with us about overcoming obstacles to God, the gospel, and the church, and what we have and how helping others. And Andrea gives us a look at some of the saints that celebrate their feasts this week.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Kyle Hyman.
This is Kyle Hyman. Welcome to Flavor of the Week. We are here at Banditos, who is an underwriter of Flavor of the Week. Oh, they're bringing the queso. This is great.
Thank you.
I am here with Father Dave Vores, my former pastor. Thank you for being here, Father
Kyle,
Dave.
Kyle, thank you very much.
It's so good to see you again.
It's fun. It's with you, and it's in front of food.
Did you miss me?
Always. You are thought of many. Every time we put a holy hour in, you and Kate are always remembered.
You know what? I want to talk about your holy hours and your prayers and the texts that you send. This is all going to come up in a future episode of Flavor of the Week. Oh, more chips. This is amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you. For your flavor, so the kind of theme of this is to pick a flavor and run with it over four episodes. So every Monday we'll try something different. We're going to do four different flavors of their, I think they called it crispy.
Crispy.
Because you like pizza.
Pizza would be the theme that I would pick. But since we're at a Mexican place, we're going to go with Mexican pizzas.
Yeah. So if I remember right, they had like a beef, a roast beef, a chorizo, and something else.
Don't know. It's a pizza. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. You opted out of the seafood, which was the fifth flavor. But we only have four flavors to try. We also got some quesos, some chips and salsa staples here. But I want to get a little background of Father Dave. You're at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton right now.
Yes.
How about your family life? Growing up, siblings?
I was a favorite of my mom and dad. No, there are seven of us, seven brothers and sisters. And I was number four, I believe. Yes, number four. And a great, great family. There's hardly a day go by that I honestly, truly don't thank God for my mom and for my dad. I deal with a lot of parents. All are good. But just so thankful of how they brought me up, and also just thankful how they taught me, and also the value of Catholic schools that we had in my upbringing.
So you went to Catholic schools, what grades?
Catholic schools, every school I ever went to was Catholic. Yeah, from grade school, St. John's, New Haven, and then went to Central Catholic, and then after that, entered the seminary at Pius X in Erlanger, Kentucky, and then graduate work was Mount St. Mary's, Emmitsburg, Maryland, where many of our men are right now. Loved everyone.
And what made you want to go into seminary after high school?
My uncle, Monsignor William Vores, was a priest for our diocese here. And he would often come over and have supper with us, always invited, and just had good influence from that. And my mom and dad, they always taught us, all seven of us, we don't know what you're going to be doing in the future, but God will call you to do something. Yeah. And they always stress it may be the call to be a priest, a religious, consecrated. It may be single life, it may be marriage, more than likely marriage. But being open to that, I just felt the call in grade school, seventh or eighth grade, to go into the seminary, to look into it. Called Father Pfister, who was the vocation director at this time. Father Pfister, God bless his soul, still over at St. Anne's right now. And he talked to me, and I discerned religious life in the Order of the Sacred Heart Fathers.
Oh.
And so went to Donaldson, Indiana, that had a seminary there, a high school seminary, and couldn't stand it. So it was a great place, learned a lot, learned the discipline of study, but after a year there said, this is not for me. And so left there, went to Central Catholic High School for 3 years, worked at Lincoln Life for a few years, and then after Lincoln Life here in Fort Wayne, I still said, I just believe God is asking me to look into priesthood. So again, I called Father Pfister 4 years later and said, I'd like more information.
Yeah.
And so then we started going into the call of discerning, am I called to that?
Yeah. So as a kid, did you feel a pull in that direction, or were you thinking, I'm going to be a firefighter or a...
No, I don't think any of us really thought of what we're going to be because we're just having a fun time as kids.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't remember ever thinking, any of my brothers and sisters, what are we going to be when we grow up? We just never really talked about it.
It seems like there's a lot of pressure on kids these days to think about that at a young age.
I think you're right. I think it's much more so, or athletics, or academics for that sake of you're going to be a great, make a lot of money, or I fear.
Right.
At times. But we had none of that. We rode our bikes every day. We just had a fun time, and we always had good close Catholic friends down the road, and we always had time with them. Uh-huh. Yeah, we just had fun.
Do you want to split up some of this?
Let's try some of this stuff.
You can try.
I'm not sure what kind that is, but there's stuff in it.
Oh, look at that. That's nice. Is that the white queso?
That's white queso.
And then this is?
That's a more yellowish something.
Was that the difference between the white queso and then the crispies on the way? Do you eat here often?
I do eat here, especially when I was down in Decatur as a pastor. Bandito's was the place we would always go to, not in Decatur, but right on the south side of Fort Wayne.
Yeah.
But I've never had their pizzas here, I'm anxious to do that.
Good queso.
That is good queso. The white stuff is really good.
I just had the yellow. Oh, they're both delicious.
This was supposed to be a fast day for me, Kyle.
How often do you fast?
I try twice a week.
Really?
The key word there is try.
And then what does that look like? What does your fasting?
Used to be when I was younger, I was taught from breakfast till about 4 o'clock, don't eat anything. Drink water, drink coffee, pop, doesn't matter. But try not to eat anything until 4. Now as I get older, my system can't handle that very well. So I have stopped where I just have a light breakfast and wait till 4 o'clock before I eat again.
Okay.
And today was supposed to be one of my fast days because traditionally we go Wednesday and Friday. Uh-huh. But that was too close together. Just too tough. So I said, I'll go Tuesday and Fridays. So since I'm eating here and enjoying it, I will move my fast day to tomorrow.
Messing it up. Yeah. So how does that become a part of your prayer, the fasting?
The fasting is supposed
It's not just a diet.
No,
right?
Oh no, this has nothing to do with diet. Matter of fact, I normally gain weight because sometimes at supper time I eat more than I normally would. But it's supposed to be a discipline to say, I am not driven by my passions. So at least as I understand it, has helped myself just avoid sin in that area.
Yeah.
By not being driven by the passion to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been nice.
So I want to get back into your discernment here. Did you do specific times of discernment? Did you do retreats or things? Oh, here come the crispies.
Oh my goodness.
This is the roast beef and ground beef.
Okay. Oh my.
And here is the chorizo and the chicken.
Oh my. Looks nice.
Can I bring you anything else?
All right. I think we're
looks good.
Knife, we can split this up.
For those listening, this thing really looks colorful.
Yeah.
It's almost like a salad. It's almost like eating a pizza is like eating a salad.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of looks pizza-ish, but it's got refried beans and the cheese and the meat and
tomatoes.
A little lettuce and tomatoes and stuff. And so now we've got four different kinds. So which one do you want to do first?
I would go ground beef first. Go this
is that
one.
The ground beef?
Yeah, I think that's ground beef.
Here, you got a knife there. I'll go ahead and just cut this one more. Ooh, it's hot.
Oh, my. Okay, it doesn't cut like a pizza.
No.
It's not cutting well at all.
Okay, so do you do discernment? Well, we're trying to figure this out here. Did you do discernment?
I did not. Back
or
in those days.
Just try it out.
Yeah, back just in those days, it was just talk to Father Pfister, the vocation director, a bit. You talk to, back in those days, it was Bishop McManus. And you sort of went.
Do you think
and discerned.
Do you think something was missing? Or do you think that was a great way to do it, just to go
and try
and jump
in? For me, back
in
those days, it was good because I think I was reasonably well-rounded by my family and just the Catholic school system and sisters who taught us, religious priests also, that did it. Yeah, I don't miss any. Today, there's a lot more, much more intensive, I think, discerning retreats and talks and sharing with spiritual directors and things like that.
What was it about your family? What was so nurturing? Do you want to split those in half and we'll each jump in on there?
Yeah, let me cut this here.
I see what you're doing. What are you doing? You got the...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, here, I can just take that whole guy right
this
there.
This whole thing here?
Yeah, right.
Because that looks
so I've got
almost
a little
the
both.
Same.
I've got... This looks like... This is chicken. And
I
then
just
this
can
is,
tell you it's hot.
All right, so you're doing the beef one first?
I'm going to try the beef. But it is so hot.
I like that.
Very good. No, it's good.
It's sweet.
It is sweet.
I wonder if this is the chorizo or the beef.
I don't know.
No. Okay. What is it about your family? What did you do? Kind of a prayer thing as a family, or
as a family?
Your parents devoted and faithful.
Yeah, my mom and dad and my grandma, who lived right next door to us, always good. We never missed Mass on Sunday. It wasn't until college that I realized people miss Mass.
Mm.
That's how protected we were, which I'm very thankful for. And the friends we hang around with, my mom and dad's friends from high school, for the most part, were all involved with Crecile or the family something movement. But yeah, they were devotions during Advent. We had the Advent wreath, and we prayed the rosary every Sunday night during Advent. Lent, we did the same thing of a rosary during the week. It wasn't forceful, but it was natural. Uh-huh. It really was natural. We learned about the Blessed Mother. My mom would always say, never write me a birthday card that says to the best mom in the world, because the Blessed Mother is the best mom in the world.
Uh-huh.
And I still, to this day, she's 95. She's over at St. Anne's. I'll write her a Mother's Day card that will say, to the world's second best mommy.
Yeah.
And it's a reflection upon what she taught me.
Yeah.
That it's all good stuff. Pretty basic. We were never, I don't recall ever having the idea during high school of, I don't want to go to Mass.
Mm-hmm.
It was just natural. We look forward to it. We're involved as servers. My dad was a lector.
Yeah.
My mom was involved in the school. So it's just good. It was just fun time.
And so seminary, you go, and from the second you're there, are you like, for sure, this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be a priest. This is it. Or did you have some doubts and questions?
My personality, Kyle, is so introverted. I am an introvert to the nth degree. And yet, as a priest, I'm not allowed to be that. That caused a few problems, still does. I still get nervous before every homily. I still get nervous before every wedding.
You're so good at
funeral.
Homilies.
I still get nervous because I'm an introvert. I'm wired as an introvert. But I don't remember what the question was now.
Did you know that you were going to be a priest?
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Thank you very much.
At seminary.
I'm also getting older. My mind doesn't work very fast. No. We're always taught, and this again, just spirituality. We were taught the only time you really know you're going to be ordained is the day that you actually have the hands of the bishop put on your head and you're ordained. But I never doubted. I would say this, which is in college, in the middle of the night, different guys just disappeared. I mean, they discerned seminary is not for them. And back in those days, they just sort of left.
Yeah.
But I have never, in the 8 years of seminary training, I never had a doubt. That doesn't make me a good priest. It just means I just never doubted it. I was just felt there was a peace about it.
Yeah.
Which I just believe was from God. I enjoyed working at Lincoln Life. I enjoy working.
Yeah.
That discipline has really helped me as a priest, just to try to put a good day of work in and things.
The way you describe that is how I would describe my marriage, that I never had any doubt. And I remember when we were doing marriage prep and at the rehearsal night and everything like that, you would always say, correct me, because you probably say this to everybody, but if you're not mature enough to stop the wedding a week before, the day before, an hour before, a minute before the ceremony, when everybody's lined up, if you're not mature enough to say, go home, this isn't something God's calling me to, then you're not mature enough to get married.
Yep. Yeah, that's very true.
And same with seminary.
Yeah.
That idea of you don't know for sure you're there until you're ordained. But once you're ordained, you're in.
You're in.
But until then, you can have that peace and know that God's calling you to, but you're always open to.
Right? With that wisdom. If I knew without any doubt that this was not for me, I don't question my mind. I would pull out.
Yeah.
I did it earlier as a freshman in high school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this is not for me. There's no peace. And that advice you received in marriage, yeah, I forgot. I haven't done that recently, so it may have just been for you.
You just knew something.
I used to do that all the time. I sort of forgot.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have many more questions. I want to talk about angels.
Mm-hmm.
You have a special dedication, your prayer life and holy hours, and the fact that you've had a lot of different seminarians shadow you or work with you, and I kind of want to talk about that relationship too.
Yeah.
And we will try three more flavors of crispy here at Banditos.
That is tremendous, Kyle.
So thank you to
My
Banditos
tummy is happy.
For underwriting our Flavor of the Week. We're here with Father Dave Vores. We're going to hear more from him next Monday for Flavor of the Week brought to you by Banditos. Try one of their 5 locations and Banditos made fresh daily.
It's good.
Joining us today is author and Catholic apologist Carlo Broussard, here to talk about his book, Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. Thanks for being here, Carlo.
No problem, Kyle. It's my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
So when I first saw the title, Prepare the Way, you know, I thought Advent. So is there any connection between Advent and the contents of this book?
No, not necessarily. No connection. The only connection would be perhaps the inspiration that Advent provided me for the title and the motif of the book coming from John the Baptist's ministry. Mm-hmm. You know, Kyle, I've always seen the ministry of apologetics akin to the ministry of John the Baptist, because often what we do in apologetics is simply clearing out the brush, clearing the way for our Lord as he is approaching the person whom we're evangelizing with the gifts of truth and life, and in particular for this book, unbelievers. So John the Baptist had to lower the hills in the mountains and fill the valleys, as the prophecy says in Isaiah chapter 40. And for us as evangelizers, often the obstacles for unbelievers are either the presence of something, like there's so much evil in the world, there's so much violence in the world,
right?
Or the lack of something. I don't have any good arguments for God. There's no scientific evidence for God. Mm-hmm. Or I've never met an authentic Christian witness, and you're nothing but a bunch of hypocrites, right? So it's either the presence of something or the absence of something. And as an evangelizer, we have to be equipped with strategies, right, on how to remove these obstacles to truth, God, Jesus, Christianity, and the church. And that's what I do in the book. So I coach you in various strategies on how to remove these various obstacles. And one of the key components of the strategies is asking simple questions to bring out ideas, expose false assumptions, and lead the conversation along.
Did you have any of these obstacles yourself in your faith journey?
You know, Kyle, not necessarily, not with regard to obstacles that unbelievers face, to be honest with you. I've never really doubted God's existence or had any problem with the obstacles that are presented here. So once I started studying the faith and came to the Lord, God was given a grace to where I was able to accept the teachings of the church. And so my journey in studying the faith was basically equipping myself for evangelization. So seeking understanding after first believing rather than inquiring in order to believe. That was just the way the Lord worked in my life, because I was never really an intellectual kind of guy. But for some reason, apologetics appealed to me when I first was introduced to it through Tim Staples' conversion story about, I don't know, 17 years ago or so. And then once I started studying apologetics, and then I came to grow in love for the Lord through that knowledge. So the knowledge deepened my love for the Lord that I had initially found in coming to the Lord.
Well, you divided the book up into 5 different parts, and the first one is prepare the way for truth. So why is that an important place to start?
Well, fundamentally, it's the basis on which everything else is built, right? So, for example, I often say you might go talk to somebody about, you know, marrying the Pope, right? But if they don't first believe in Jesus, then what's the point of talking about that stuff, right? You got to first talk about Jesus. But if you go to talk to someone about Jesus, if they don't first believe in God, well, then, well, you got to back up a little bit. Well,
right.
You might start talking to an atheist or someone about God's existence, but if they, you know, they could simply revert back and say, well, there is no absolute truth. I don't care what you say about God. I don't care what kind of argument you provide for me for God's existence, because no absolute truth exists. So what's true for you is not true for me. So that brings us to the question of, is there objective truth? truth, and how do we critique or remove this obstacle of relativism that is prevalent throughout contemporary culture and is absorbing the minds of many people, especially millennials, you know, especially younger people. So in the book, I coach you in various strategies on how to remove that obstacle, the fundamental strategy being showing how relativism is self-refuting. So if we can prove the proposition, there is no absolute truth to be false, well, then its opposite, there is absolute truth, would be true. And the way we do that is just to show that the statement, there is no absolute truth, is a statement about objective reality. That's a truth statement or a truth claim in and of itself. And the sort of the question that you would ask your relativist friend would be, well, if you say there is no absolute truth, is that absolutely true? And so if they say yes, well, then there's at least one absolute truth you acknowledge, right. Namely, there is no absolute truth,
right.
Which basically violates the principle of contradiction. Because you're saying it's absolutely true that there is no absolute truth, which is absurd. So the opposite, therefore, is true. There is absolute truth. So that at least, Kyle, establishes a foundation that there is truth. Then we have to proceed and inquire to figure out what that absolute truth is. And of course, that requires some work and patience. And that's what I try to bring out in the book. You know, as we go through removing other obstacles to truth, such as people believe so many different things. And then we get to the obstacles to acknowledging God's existence, the problem of evil, the problem of divine hiddenness, and the arguments for God, and how science and the question of God relate. So I deal with those obstacles as well, on to Jesus, Christianity, and the church.
Yeah, getting back to the idea of relativism and people thinking that truth doesn't exist, is that a recent phenomenon, do you think, or is it at least worse today than it has been in the past, or is this always been an issue that we've been fighting?
Yeah, I mean, you can find roots of it, tracing it back all the way to the pre-Socratics, man, where, you know, you have statements such as man is the measure of all things, you know, but then we find it sort of resurface with Immanuel Kant and the Enlightenment period, et cetera, after Immanuel Kant and then in the Enlightenment period, you know, Immanuel Kant being this philosopher who stated that rather than truth being the mind conforming to reality, it's basically reality, the outside world, conforming to the mind, that the mind pretty much constructs all of this stuff that's coming in, and you find the roots of relativism in that. But we do find sort of this recent push of relativism, especially on the university campus, where truth is seen as something subjective, something relative to what an individual happens to think, and that there is no such thing as truth independent of what you or I think or what a society thinks. And so a phenomenon that has been occurring for many centuries, right? We've been dealing with it in the intelligentsia as well as on the popular level for quite some time. But we do in recent times see a big push of relativism, especially, Kyle, with this label of intolerance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like nobody wants to draw a line or a boundary and take a stand on what is true out of fear of offending someone else, out of fear of being perceived as being intolerant, right? And fundamentally, of course, that's just a flawed understanding of tolerance. Tolerance is not accepting everyone's opinions and beliefs as equal and valid. Tolerance necessarily involves disagreeing with someone, because when I am tolerant, when I respect your dignity as a human being, Kyle, but yet I still disagree with you. But to disagree involves saying someone's wrong. So we're slapped with the label of being intolerant for saying someone's wrong, but yet saying someone's wrong necessarily belongs to the essence of tolerance. So it's just a flawed understanding of tolerance. And see, I think the fundamental problem, Kyle, is many people are scared or afraid to make a truth claim. I mean, this brings up another point I address in the book, because they think that to make a truth claim is going to lead to violence. Huh. And that violence doesn't necessarily belong to the essence of truth itself. violence is often perpetrated in the name of truth, but that's a perversion of the truth. Because if we come to the truth about the nature and the dignity of the human being, we're not going to go around killing everybody in order to persuade people to believe what we believe. We're going to be extending an invitation to embrace the truth, because we know the truth will ultimately perfect us as human beings and make us happy.
Our guest is Carlo Broussard, Catholic Answers apologist, speaker, author of the book, Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And with all of these obstacles, this is a really thick book. There's a lot of things in here, but really short, concise responses and strategies for approaching different obstacles. Of all of these obstacles, what do you think is either the biggest obstacle for people or the most common? And maybe that's the same thing.
Well, basically, Kyle, it's the problem of evil, I would think. I mean, just the other day I was on an airplane, I was on a flight heading to give a talk, and I was reading through my manuscript, and the lady was like, wow, that's some interesting stuff you're reading there. She was peeking over my shoulder, and so she asked, well, what is it? I said, it's my manuscript for a book, and she said, wow, what's your book about? So I was able to engage her in a conversation, but lo and behold, what came out was, you know, how do you justify an all good God and the existence of evil in the world? So in the book, I devote two chapters addressing the logical problem of evil. Like, first of all, you know, does evil logically contradict God's existence? And then secondly, one version of the problem of evil is called the evidential version, which states that maybe evil doesn't logically contradict God's existence, but there's so much evil in the world, how can God possibly exist, right? There's so much pointless evil and pointless suffering in the world. No good could possibly come from. And so I address that. But then I also, Kyle, provide a chapter from the Christian perspective. So I provide a philosophical response to the problem of evil, but also a theological response to show what sort of light Christianity sheds in the midst of the darkness of suffering. That Christianity, through Christian revelation, we actually have insight to how suffering can be imbued with purpose and meaning. And namely, the ultimate purpose and meaning of suffering is that when united to Christ, it can bring about the salvation of our own souls and the salvation of others. We call it redemptive suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So in this conversation with this lady, I kind of touched on some of the philosophical issues as well to appeal to her intellect. But then I provided her evidence from Christian revelation to show that Jesus has an answer to the problem of suffering. And that is to use that discordant note and to create a whole new symphony with it, to quote Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. And so Jesus imbues suffering with purpose and meaning, but also promises to redeem all suffering. So no matter how tragic suffering may be in this life, it's not ultimately tragic, because Jesus promises a glory and a reward that goes far beyond in comparison to the sufferings of this life. As St. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, you know, the sufferings of this life pale in comparison to the glory to come. And then, of course, I deal with the problem of hell and the problem of divine hiddenness, which are all sort of species of the problem of evil. So that's sort of the common problem, the common obstacle that many people face. And I coach you, the reader, in strategies on how to remove these obstacles, whether it's a philosophical issue or it's just the issue of trying to find purpose and meaning in the midst of evil in the world.
We have about a minute left. When you're talking about removing obstacles, are you talking about removing obstacles that you have yourself? Is this book intended for the person with the obstacles or to equip the person that's going to evangelize to the person that has the obstacles?
The primary purpose of the book is the latter. So I wrote the book to coach you, the Catholic or even the non-Catholic Christian, because many of the topics go beyond the boundaries of the visible boundaries of Catholicism. So I'm coaching you, the reader, in strategies on how to go forth and evangelize and remove obstacles for unbelievers who have these obstacles to truth, God, Jesus, Christianity, and the Church. However, in a secondary way, if a person is struggling with some of these obstacles themselves, and of course they recognize this is a manual to coach Catholics to evangelize, and they can sort of get over that and get past that, well, then the book would be beneficial for them as well, because the book provides the arguments against various objections that a person may be struggling with, him or herself. And so the book would be beneficial for that person as well.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Carlo Broussard. I appreciate you being here.
You're welcome, Kyle.
Again,
thank
the book
you,
is
my friend. God bless you.
Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. You can get it at Catholic.com or wherever you get books, Amazon and such. But Catholic.com, you can find out more about Carlo Broussard and speaking, and a great author, great speaker. It would be great for your event. So who do we have that we're celebrating this week?
Well, today is the Feast of St. Matthias. So, kind of fitting that it's the day after the Ascension, because it was right after the Ascension that good old St. Matthias became an apostle.
Replacement. Substitute. Bring in the subs.
So, he was chosen to replace Judas as the 12th apostle. St. Peter oversaw the process. They gathered, you can read about this in Acts, they gathered everyone together and they prayed, and then they had a drawing for lots between Matthias and the other man. So Matthias is chosen and then never mentioned again in the entire New Testament. apparently, he's the patron saint of the Diocese of Gary in Indiana. So Happy feast day to our neighbors to the west.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also like to nominate him for patron saint of being thrown headfirst into a difficult new job.
Yes.
Right? I can't imagine you're just following along with Jesus, because he did. That was one of the requirements, was that the disciple had been there with Jesus through his whole teaching, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh wait, I have to be in charge. Okay, guys. So anyway, shout out to St. Matthias. You can pray to him when you start your new jobs. Tuesday, tomorrow, May 15th, St. Isidore the Farmer. If you have not ever learned anything about St. Isidore the Farmer, you totally should. A really cool patron for those of us who are lay people, who sort of, because he was not a priest or anything like that. He just really committed his life into service of God in kind of a simple way, but also heroically holy. He was a Spanish farm worker. He was known for his piety toward the poor and animals. He started working for a farm owner when he was just a little kid and kept working for that same farmer his whole life. Eventually, he married a holy woman who herself has become a saint. She's Blessed Maria de la Cabeza, Saint Mary of the Head. I don't know why the head. We'll keep you posted about that for her feast day, maybe. Anyway, some of these really amazing stories about him. In the morning before going to work, St. Isidore would usually attend Mass at one of the churches in Madrid. And then one day, his fellow farm workers complained that he was always showing up late in the morning. So upon investigating, his boss found Isidore at prayer while an angel was doing his plowing work for him. Huh. Isn't that amazing? Another story says that angels helped Isidore plow, so he was doing three times the work of the other men.
Nice.
That's so great.
I need some of those.
Yeah, right, St. Isidore. Send me some angels. Another story says St. Isidore's wife, Maria, always kept a pot of stew on the fireplace in their home so that there'd be enough, because Isidore would often bring people home who were poor or who he knew were hungry and wouldn't have their own food to eat.
Mm.
Well, one day he brought home lots and lots of hungry people, way more than usual, and she served as many of them as she could, but she still didn't have quite enough. And she said, I'm sorry, there's just not enough anymore. And he insisted, go back and look again. And there was enough food to feed everyone, miraculously.
Nice.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So this is, I think, a good example of the Lord will not be outdone in generosity.
Check again.
Right? Check out some stuff about St. Isidore the Farmer this week, because he's a really cool saint.
If your bank account's been low, check again.
Right? St. Isidore. Have my back, buddy. Okay. To Wednesday, May 16th, St. Margaret of Cortona. Really, I had never heard of her, but she has a similar story to St. Augustine's, his whole Lord make me pure, but not yet.
Right.
She fell in love when she was young and then lived with the man, Arsenio, for many years without getting married. They had a son together. One day she was waiting for Arsenio, but instead his dog came. And so she followed the dog and he led her into the woods, where she found out Arsenio had been murdered.
Oh my.
And she was so shocked and upset, she decided immediately to give her life over to God, and she dedicated the whole rest of her life to penance and Eucharistic adoration and giving advice to repentant sinners like herself. She became a tertiary Franciscan. Her son became a Franciscan.
Okay.
So she's a patron saint of repentant sinners and that kind of thing. Single moms too. Another saint on Wednesday, St. Simon Stock. If you wear a brown scapular, you have the Blessed Mother, of course, and also St. Simon Stock to thank. St. Simon was a Carmelite, and Mary appeared to him and said, "Receive, my beloved son, this scapular of thy order. It is a special sign of my favor, which I have obtained for thee and for thy children of Mount Carmel. He who dies clothed with this habit shall be preserved from eternal fire." It is the badge of salvation, a shield in time of danger, and a pledge of special peace and protection. So that is where there are 18 different kinds of scapulars that are approved now.
That would be an interesting episode.
But the very first one, the brown scapular, St. Simon Stock. So that's Wednesday.
Okay.
Thursday, May 17th, St. Pascal Bailon, another Spanish saint this week. St. Pascal was from a poor family, and he had to start working as a shepherd when he was very young, but he always prayed as he worked. And even though he couldn't attend daily mass himself, he paid special attention to listen for church bells because they would ring during the consecration, and then he would say a special prayer.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, he became a Franciscan, but he turned down the opportunity to study for the priesthood because he wanted to take on all the humble roles like doorkeeper and gardener and cook and beggar instead.
Hmm.
Friday, May 18th, Pope St. John I, most popular papal name, and he was the very first, but that's not why they canonized him. Not just for being the first. He was the pope during the height of the Arian heresy, which denied the divinity of Jesus. So Pope John had to deal not only with the heresy itself, but with all these political rivalries that were exacerbated by it because the Arian leader would punish the Catholics and the Catholic leaders would punish the Arians. And it was a mess. Eventually, he even was martyred for some of the work that he was doing with them. Saturday, May 19th, St. Theophilus of Corte, a Franciscan priest who specialized in leading retreats.
Huh.
And I don't know anything else about him.
Okay.
Sunday, May 20th is Pentecost.
Right.
Just so everyone knows, keep that in mind. Maybe wear red to mass. Also, the feast of St. Bernardine of Siena. He was known as the greatest preacher of his time, journeying across Italy, calming strife-torn cities, attacking the paganism he found, attracting crowds of 30,000 and more. The Pope at the time even compared him to St. Paul because of all of the evangelization work he was doing.
Nice.
He also, you know the IHS symbol with the sun? St. Bernardine is the one who designed that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's
a good design.
Yeah.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We'd love it if you followed us on social media where we can keep the conversation going. We are at Kyle Hyman Show on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Snapchat. That's at Kyle Hyman Show. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode. Until then, remember to leave room for the Holy Spirit. One of the things that we do on Mondays is give you a little evangelization challenge, some way that you can share your faith. I was thinking to give somebody a book. You could buy something online and have it shipped to them that you know that they're going to enjoy. Or maybe just something that you read and it's sitting on your bookshelf. You know you're not going to read it again, but it was helpful to you. Pass that on and share the faith through sharing a book. If you were listening on Friday, our tri-bond was Unhappy Unions, Happy Bowlers, Angry Rattlesnakes. The hint I gave was that the Unhappy Unions has nothing to do with marriages. The unions that they're talking about are the unions like at workplaces. They all strike. Unhappy unions, happy bowlers, angry rattlesnakes all strike. Today's tri-bond, three things that have one thing in common. Of confusion, of decay, of mind. It's not that they all three start with of. If you know the answer, email show@redeemerradio.com. Call or text the Holy Cross College text line at 260-436-9598. Again, it is of confusion, of decay, of mind.
My toddler seems to like always be giving me sicknesses. She's not even in school yet.
Not daycare or
anything
like that? No,
she doesn't
go
to daycare. The only thing she does is once a week, she spends some time with my nephew who's in school, and somehow that like half an hour that she spends with him once a week seems to be enough to infect us.
Yep. Gotta put everything in your mouth. Yes. Gotta transfer those germs.
Exactly.
It's efficient.